Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts in the Bay Area. I'm Noah Griffin, sitting in this week for host David LaTulip. Today I'll be talking with John Skelly and Benjamin Papak, the stars of the West Coast production of J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. Following that, we will be talking with Jomar Tagatak and Kim Holkamp-Dinan of the holiday production of The Christmas Carol. Following that, there will be a recorded segment on The Nutcracker. Well, Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, they play the parts of Harry Potter and his son, Albus Potter. Harry Potter and the Cursed Child runs at San Francisco's Curran Theater, 445 Geary Street, through June of 2020. Harry Potter and the Cursed Child is the eighth story in J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter series and the first official Harry Potter story to be presented on stage. It has received universal acclaim for its breathtaking magic and stage wizardry. Harry Potter and the Cursed Child is the most awarded play in theater history, with 25 major U.S. awards, including 6 Tony Awards, with one of those for the best play. It also won 24 major awards in Britain's Olivier Awards, winning a record-breaking 9 awards, including Best New Play. And we're just delighted to have these stars with us. Let me tell you a little bit of background about the story. It begins 19 years after the events of the 2007 novel Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows and follows Harry Potter, now head of the Department of Magical Law Enforcement at the Ministry of Magic, and his younger son Albus Severus Potter, who is about to attend Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
You know, what is it like to start with you, John, to inhabit a character, especially Harry Potter, that's already been defined and shaped by one actor and seen in 7 movies?
It's a little bit intimidating, of course. And of course, everyone who I think sees the play is going to have an idea of who their Harry Potter is, especially if they've read the novels. And I think that people might be surprised at what they see when they come and see the show. You know, Harry is older. He's maybe wiser, but he's, he saved the wizarding world, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's got it all figured out. He struggles with how to be a parent. He struggles with how to be a husband, and he struggles with how to be a professional head of magical law enforcement. You know, all of a sudden he's pushing papers. He's used to being out in the field and catching the bad guys, and now his role has changed a little bit, and he's still figuring everything out.
And Benjamin, what is it like for you to play the son?
Well, you know, one of the defining struggles Albus has in his relationship with his dad is facing the legacy of his dad. Harry Potter is this internationally renowned figure in the wizarding world, celebrated as a hero everywhere you go. And Albus is struggling just to get through school and get passing grades in something as simple as charms class. Having the shadow of the Harry Potter lingering over him everywhere he goes is one of the main things that Albus has to deal with in their relationship.
Behind the scenes, how much did you all have to talk this all out to where you got a relationship, a real relationship?
A lot. I mean, we rehearsed the show beginning at the end of July. Mm-hmm. So we rehearsed in Berkeley for about 8 weeks, and then we had a month of technical rehearsals. And during that time, I mean, we spent a lot of time trying to develop our relationship as father and son and develop all of the relationship in the play, of course.
Yeah, we had a lot of thorough conversations about ways in which Harry and Albus connected or struggled to connect that aren't even covered in the script itself. But I really think the relationship fleshed itself out through rehearsal of the scenes in the story. The more we listened to each other, the more we found nuances in what was happening between us in the scenes is really where it started to come to life.
Do you bring out things from your own experiences with your own fathers in this?
You know, somewhat, yeah. I mean, you kind of can't help but to draw on your own experiences of what it's like to grow up and what it's like to, I don't have any children myself, but of course that imagination, it doesn't take much to imagine what it would be like to have a child who's struggling and to not be able to connect. And in some ways, that mirrored Ben and I's relationship in the as we were rehearsing, you know, struggling to connect, figure out how do we come together and make this play together. And, you know, and by the end, not to spoil the play, but but I will say that Benjamin and I have found a lasting peace.
You know, it's so funny. Like, the relationship I have with my dad in real life is mm-hmm. so different from the one that Albus and Harry have in the show. But even so, I think there's a moment that everyone has when they see the flaws in their parent. They see the fact that, oh, yeah, they're a human just like I am. And that's something that, – that moment of disillusionment is something we can all resonate with. And I definitely think that brought value to the work that we did together.
Mm-hmm. Having come together like that, does the relationship change from night to night?
Yes. Yeah, it does. I say yes and no because obviously the lines we say are the lines we say and the scenes are the scenes. But it's a, you know, as live theater is a living, breathing thing and it changes every night. And that's the joy of getting to do this play is that we are continually rediscovering what it is that makes our characters tick and how we're coming together and apart. And the great thing is we have a long time to continue to figure that out. I know you said we're running through June. We're actually just released some tickets to through the beginning of July. So
good.
So, yeah.
That's very positive. Let's talk about the magic. You all had to really learn some magic and some wizardry on the show.
Yeah. the very first day of rehearsals, they threw us right into it with what they called Introduction to Magic. And, you know, they showed us some, like, basic level illusions and tricks that you can do. But the example that stuck with me from that was they did this exercise called Hide the Scissors. Mm. And what the illusions directors did was they all stuck their arms out in front of us and they crossed them to make, like, a giant scissor. And they had everybody in the room do it. And then they walked up to each person who had their arms crossed. It didn't matter if it was left over right over left. And they would tell them, your scissors are open, your scissors are closed. Your scissors are open, your scissors are closed. And we had to observe one another and figure out what they were looking at to determine whether our scissors were open or closed. And the point was, it wasn't the arms. It wasn't the shape we were making with our hands. It was something else that we were doing physically. In that case, it was whether or not your mouth was open or closed. Was actually determining whether the scissors were open or closed. And the point of that was when you do illusions work, you want to draw the audience's attention to something that's very interesting but isn't actually what's making the illusion itself work. And there's this beautiful storytelling that we get to do with that.
So are these professional magicians that come in and teach you this?
Yeah. So Jamie Harrison's the illusions creator and director and then the people who have worked with him came and helped us, Skylar, and Chris, and
Andrew Evans.
Andrew Evans, who's a local magician here, actually has his show,
Magic Patio.
The Magic Patio. So go check him out. And they really come in and help to teach us all of the basic structure of the illusions, and then it's a lot of practice. I mean, it is hours and hours of perfecting every move because. You know, it's one thing if you forget a line on stage or if, you know, you might be a second late to an entrance. We all know sort of how to figure that out and work around that. If something goes wrong in a magic trick, there's nothing really to be done other than to go, whoops, and keep moving forward because, you know, it's once it's out there, it's out there.
I guess on the stage, if you're a magician and also if you're a surgeon, there's a couple of words you don't want to hear.
Oops.
I think, oh, dear, would be a little bit better. What are your favorite times of magic tricks? Which were your favorite ones? Or without giving anything away.
Right.
No, don't have to tell how you do it. But
No. I think, you know, one of the things I love about the magic in the show is that it's very much in service of the story. So a magic trick will happen, and before you almost have time to realize that it was a magic trick, the story is moving on, and you better be paying attention. And that really helps us both to hide our scissors and to keep the story moving in a way that's really engaging. And one of the things I love that we do is in the world of Harry Potter, if you take Polyjuice, you turn into another character. You transform into that person. And so we get to do that, and it's a great, great fun part of the show, especially for me. You know, Harry's a Harry's a serious guy, and then I get to transform into somebody else and play that for a while, and that's a really a lot of fun.
Speaking of being two, there are two parts to this story. Is every cast member in both of them?
Yes. Yes, we all play, well, some people play multiple roles, but yes, both, so it's in two parts, and both stories are connected, so it's a part one and a part two, and yeah.
Now, where's your home? Are you all, you're obviously living in San Francisco now, are you from the Bay Area or different places?
No, I've been living in Los Angeles for the past 5 years, and before that I grew up in Georgia, just south of Atlanta.
And I am currently, I was living in New York. For about 5 years prior to this, and I grew up in Minnesota.
Where were the auditions for this? Where were the auditions?
All over. Yeah, they've. So I was part of the original Broadway company as an understudy for Harry Potter, and so I did my audition in New York. But I know they've auditioned. We have people in the show from Chicago, mm-hmm. from Canada, from LA, mm-hmm. from all over the place.
Yeah, they did original calls in Los Angeles, Chicago, Toronto, New York, and I think a couple other cities.
Yeah.
We're talking with John Skelly and Benjamin Papak, the stars of J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, finding a little something about their background. How do you find San Francisco compared to where you've been from? Where you've been from, that's a great one. I think my English teacher would shoot me on that one.
No, I'm really enjoying it so far. I live in Nob Hill right now. It's a beautiful area. I can walk everywhere. The nightlife is really lovely. There's a ton of culture. Yeah.
It's been great. I especially love... Compared to New York, the amount of green space here, I'm not too far away from Golden Gate Park, and to be able to walk into Golden Gate Park and just...
So do you live in the Richmond or the Sunset?
I'm down below, down near Inner Sunset.
Oh, okay.
And so it's just a beautiful city and a beautiful park and beautiful place to be.
Well, they say everything's misnamed in San Francisco. There's no one rich in the Richmond. There's no sun in the Sunset. There's no beach in North Beach and only love in the Hate. So go figure. So let me ask you, do you anticipate being with the show beyond June? You said it's going to be running through July as well.
We'll see. I mean, I know that we...
I mean, they don't change actors in the middle of the run.
You know, at some point, I'm sure that may happen. But, you know, for as long as foreseeable future, we'll be with the show. And, you know, I was... So speaking of like the New York production, I was a part of that for about the first year of the production, and then they
something like that. When you're staying with the production for a year, how do you keep it fresh every night?
Oh man, that's a practice. You know, I've been thinking recently. It's almost a little bit like meditating every day. Like we go out there and we focus on being present, mm-hmm. as present as possible with one another, and it really comes down to the listening.
Yeah, and then the audience is different every day too, so that always changes things. The audiences are great, and hearing them react to the magic and hearing them really get into the story is always really fun, and that's what it's about.
What percentage are adults and what percentage are kids in your audience?
Boy, I don't know. Usually, you know, we've got a lot of kids with their parents, and I've been surprised at just how many kids I've seen out there. It's a really great because the story is, I think it's for adults and for kids. It will hopefully capture their imaginations. But it's also a deep story about what it is to be a parent and what it is to struggle with that.
Is there anything in literature that you could compare to this?
Ooh.
In literature? Well, I mean, it comes from youth literature. I mean, there are 7 beautiful, successful stories written by J.K. Rowling. This is just a continuation of that story.
I understand that he sent a letter, or Rowling sent a letter to... You all at the beginning?
Yeah,
she did.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, she sent us a letter right before opening night. You know, just expressing her thanks and her love and her blessing for the show, and which was really amazing to get. And you know, we hoped. She said she hopes that she can come see it sometime, and we're hopeful that she can make it out. And she said that the prison in the stories is Azkaban, which was actually based partially on Alcatraz.
Really?
Yeah. So.
Yeah, she actually said San Francisco is one of her favorite cities.
Yeah, so we're hoping she can come out and see it.
Hopefully all roads lead to San Francisco.
Yes.
You're at Nob Hill and you're close to the Golden Gate Park. You're close to 2 iconic places right there. What do you anticipate beyond this? Is there anything that you hope to do? Is this something that you had in mind all your lives, I want to be a part of this production? Or is it something that came along and your agent said, you got to go audition for this?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I just finished a job. I was doing a Shakespeare play, and I'd been unemployed for a couple of weeks, and all of a sudden I got a call, and they said, you know, they're looking for an understudy for Harry Potter on Broadway, and do you want to go in? And I said, duh, of course. And so I went in, auditioned, and a few days later, I was part of the company. I joined the company a little late, and they had just won the Tony Award, so I got to watch the Tony Awards and go, oh good, my play that I'm in has just won the best play. And now the journey has taken me this far, and I have no idea where the journey is going to take me from here, but I'm excited to find out.
For me, this is the job of a lifetime. I mean, my mother taught me to read on Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone when I was 6 years old, and she would do like different character voices, and you know, in a certain creative way, that was kind of my introduction to acting too, I guess. So I've been in love with these stories since my early childhood, which I think a lot of people are. And you know, you were talking about audience membership, adults versus children. I think there are a lot of adult fans for this show because they grew up with the stories just like I did. So I'm just grateful to be here every day. I love this job so much. I went through, 7 months of auditioning?
Wow.
9 different auditions.
7 months of auditioning?
Yeah, I auditioned in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York for this show over several months. So it was an incredible process to be here, and I'm grateful every day for it.
How do you keep yourself positive with all of that?
Are you kidding? It's all gratitude. The fact that I get to be here, and I really get the sense that I earned it not just through the hard work that I put in, but also thanks to the help of a lot of important people along the way. So it doesn't matter if it's an easy day, if it's a hard day, if the show feels great. I'm always grateful to be here.
That's wonderful. You guys have done a great job. Thank you so much. We've been talking with John Skelly and Benjamin Papik, the stars of Harry Potter, The Cursed Child, which they play the parts again of Harry Potter and his son, Albus Potter. Harry Potter and the Cursed Child runs at San Francisco's Curran Theater, 445 Geary Street, and through July, as I understand it now, 2020. And also, if you want to go online, you can find out about them. I watch a little bit on YouTube, Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, www.youtube.com. And we want to thank you both for appearing on KLW with me.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Hi, this is Noah Griffin, back with KALW. We're going to be talking with our guests about A Christmas Carol. We're talking with Jomar Tagatak and also Kim Hallkamp-Dinan. That now it's in its 43rd year, A Christmas Carol is the cornerstone of ACT's repertory and has become a holiday tradition for families around the world. ACT's version of A Christmas Carol was adopted by Paul Walsh and Kerry Parloff and stays true to the heart of Dickens' timeless story and redemption. Performances run through December 24th at ACT's Geary Theater here in San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Hi, how are you?
Well, let's ask the question about your interest in the Christmas Carol. Is it something that you're familiar with from the time you were a child or something that came up in your radar to audition for and said, I might do that.
Yeah, so the first time that, actually, the first professional show that I ever saw was Christmas Carol at Actors Theater of Louisville. I'm from Jeffersonville, Indiana, so that was the first big show that my parents took me to see, and I just like remember being mesmerized by all of the magic and being moved by this like really wonderful tale of redemption. And then I am a third year MFA at the American Conservatory.
Master of Fine Arts.
Yes. So I'm a third year there, and every year the third years are in this production of A Christmas Carol. So I've been really excited to audition and be a part of this ever since I got accepted into ACT 3 years ago. So,
Jamar?
Yeah. You know, I've known about this story since I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And A Christmas Carol here at ACT was my first professional show. I was an MFA student, a Master of Fine Arts student, back in 2000. Oh, do I have to say it?
Say it.
Back in 2000. I graduated in 2005. So I played, since it was my first professional show, I played young Scrooge at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And years later, I don't even want to count how many years later, but now I'm playing Bob Cratchit. So it's a nice sort of journey with this story to go from playing that character, that younger character, to a father.
Why don't you remind the listeners, some of whom might actually not even know the storyline, about what the storyline is all about?
Sure. So Christmas Carol centers around Ebenezer Scrooge, who is this mean, grumpy, grouchy type of greedy type of person. And he's visited by three ghosts, who Kim is playing one of the ghosts.
Yes.
Christmas Past.
I am the ghost of Christmas Past.
So he's visited by these three ghosts, Christmas Past, Christmas Present, and the ghost of Christmas Future. Actually, four ghosts, right? Jacob Marley.
Yeah, if you count Jacob Marley.
And through that, through these visitations, he goes through a transformation within his soul,
mm-hmm.
From this greedy, sort of mean, grumpy guy to a gentler, embodying the spirit of Christmas. So you see this journey with him, and it sort of highlights the fact that everybody has joy in their heart, even the most grumpiest, you know, men.
And he says that because it's a little countercasting, correct?
Yeah.
Kimberly, have you played a man before?
Have I played a man? Yes, I have. I've played a couple of men. Most recently, during some projects and stuff that we were working on at school, I played Cassius in Julius Caesar, which was really fun. And then I did a production of The Lieutenant of Inishmore, mm-hmm. by Martin McDonagh, and I played Christy, who is the leader of a sect of the IRA who has one eye. And that was very exciting and fun.
How do you train to do that? Do you lower your voice or not? Do you change your body movements?
What do you do? So, I mean, I use my chest voice a lot more. So, like, right now, I think naturally I kind of talk a little bit through my sinuses and, like, my nose, my, like, upper register,
mm-hmm.
Midwestern things. And then when I play a man, I try to talk a little bit more in my chest voice. And then I change the way that I walk. So a lot of times if I'm playing a man, I kind of, like, try to move my hips like cowboys move their hips. That's mm-hmm. just something that I do. And then it, like, makes my walk very different, and, like, it makes the way that I hold myself very different than, like, Kim would in regular life, which is very fun.
Well, you talk about Indiana and Kentucky. Those are both places where Lincoln spent his time. And
yeah.
His accent was very different. He said cheered for chair and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of speech do you use in this? Do you use a British or standard American or Brit speak, if I can coin a phrase?
You know, the cast of Christmas Carol, we're a very diverse cast.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not using the British dialect. We use our own voice and our own mm-hmm. dialect to fill the story.
So that doesn't get in the way of somebody's listening to it. I mean, when you see the former production, some go back to the 1930s, mm-hmm. and there's some in the 50s. And did you use that for inspiration at all, or did you just take it fresh?
Well, you know, there's a little bit of dramaturgy that goes into this. So, you know, we go back to the novel sometimes and things like that, and they can be very, very helpful. But I think, you know, the fact that we use our own kind of natural speech or American dialect goes to show how universal this story is. So no matter what dialect you hear, you can still relate to the characters. You can still relate mm-hmm. to Scrooge or Bob mm-hmm. Cratchit, the kids, the ghosts of, you know, of Christmas past, present, future, you know, all that. So I think that's what makes this story so strong and why we produce this show every year, just to get into the Christmas spirit of it all.
So, what's your relationship with Tiny Tim?
What's my relationship with Tiny Tim?
Insofar as, you know, he's a father, son, and did you have to talk this out with whoever plays Tiny Tim a lot beforehand to work it out?
Yeah, you know, through the rehearsal process, naturally you become, you know, there are so many kids in this show, and they're around us all the time, mm-hmm. Which makes it for a really fun rehearsal, a hectic, crazy rehearsal. But you naturally become close to the kids. And I think, you know, specifically to Tim, because we have all these scenes together,
sure, yeah.
we naturally have developed this sort of father-son bond through that, just getting to know each other, you know. You know, off stage, we'd talk about, you know, our favorite things, like she likes, you know, the things that kids like, iPad games and
these are a few candy. Of my favorite things. It's Christmas season, of course.
So, yeah, it's something that we didn't really talk about formally, but it's just something that develops. You know, you can't help but have a relationship with the actors around you. Yeah.
And Kimberly, you said that your final year in getting your Master
yes,
of Fine Arts.
Yeah.
And you have several of your classmates that are in this production. Is that correct?
Yeah. My whole class is in the show, which is awesome. And everyone plays various roles. So Jomar was talking about how when he was in MFA, he played young Scrooge. One of my classmates, Matt, is playing young Scrooge. And then one of the Scrooges was our acting teacher for Shakespeare and for Tennessee Williams. So that's really cool. But all 12 of us are in it. Fred is an MFA. The young woman that young Scrooge falls in love with is an MFA. Mm-hmm. For a lot of us, it's our first professional show, and we're also getting our actor's equity card.
How does that come about, getting the equity card?
Well, you can get an equity card really, I guess, in just two ways. So you can... you can join EMC, where you do a bunch of different...
Explain what EMC is, please.
EMC is Equity Membership Candidate, mm-hmm. is what it stands for. And so what happens is you do a bunch of... Well, or you do a whatever shows you can that can qualify for getting you equity points. And then when you do a certain amount of shows that equal a certain amount of points, then you can apply for equity membership. Or some shows like Christmas Carol, you can just be cast in, and then you get offered an equity contract, and you can sign that and become equity. Yeah.
And what does that entitle you to do once you become equity?
So equity means a lot of different things. And Jomar, maybe you can help me out since I'm just now joining equity, and you've been equity for a while. Mm-hmm. But there, being part of Actors Equity Association is being part of a union, so... it guarantees you to have certain rights and certain levels of payment. Mm-hmm. And it gives you health insurance if you work for a certain amount of weeks. It's all very complicated. But basically, like, you're offered certain levels of protection and, like, mm-hmm. rights to work and how people can and cannot take advantage of you as an artist who just, like, wants to create all this wonderful art all the time in a world full of other wonderful artists
yeah.
that can feel cutthroat, but it's not.
Yeah, and it connects you to other, you know, Actors Equity has a support system, so it connects you to other actors. It gives you information on, just like Kim said, health insurance, pensions, things like that. funny fact or interesting connection, the person who is playing young Scrooge now, Matt Monaco, me and him are, me and him, I don't know if that's the right one, but we are both from the same small town.
Where's home for you?
Yeah, I grew up in, well, I was born in the Philippines, but my father's military, so we were stationed in Beale Air Force Base, and there's a town next to that called Marysville. And the sister town or sister city is Yuba City, and that's where Matt's from. I saw Matt during rehearsal wearing a Yuba City shirt, and I said, Matt, are you from Yuba City? And he's like, yeah, I know. We have the same teachers. We figured out. It was crazy. So it's a funny little connection that way.
That's one of the craziest cards I ever get. Somebody came by my apartment and missed me, and he said, sorry I missed you. Juan Corona, contractor, Yuba City.
You know.
Well, how much do you depend upon the actual book itself and then, you know, as resource and reference material for what you're doing? Or is that really kind of not allowed? You're just supposed to look at the four corners of what the script is.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question because, you know, probably, you know, that kind of literature is was probably the most helpful for the writers of the play, Cary Perloff and Paul Walsh, going back to that, referencing that. Our job as actors, Kim, if you want to jump in, is to look at the story as it is written to us, given to us on the first day of rehearsal, using that as sort of the jumping off point, because, you know, using that text, because that's really all we have to tell the story, you know. And it's really great, you know, if people have read the book so that they can compare the book or reference the book. But really for us as actors, it's all about that script that's in front of us.
Yeah. I mean, I read... I'm a really big Charles Dickens fan anyway. I just am. So I reread the story a couple of times before rehearsal started. But I mean, I read that script like a million. but I mean, we have to rely on the text, but I did pull a lot of inspiration imagery from the original story. Because like, so for Christmas Past, in our version, is like this ethereal, like fairy-like woman who watches Scrooge like a hawk, but is also kind of like Glinda the Good Witchy. But in the original story, the ghost of Christmas Past is like this tiny little man who's described as an ancient child who has a light that emanates from his forehead, and he covers it with a nightcap. And like, that's not really the case in our production. Like Christmas Past still has the same goals and kind of comes in a very similar way and takes Scrooge through all of the same memories.
You do glow though. You do glow.
Yeah, I do wear a lot of glitter. A lot of glitter.
How has playing these roles changed each of you individually?
Oh, man.
Whoa, that's a deep, deep question. You know, I love playing the character of Bob Cratchit because he has such a, although he doesn't glow like Christmas Past, but he has such a light. You know, he's not the wealthiest of men. He's got a huge, huge family that he has to take care of, but he has joy, you know, and he's sort of this light throughout the story, and is happy most of the time, all the time. And I think for me, it's just a reminder, you know, that, you know, when you feel stressed or when you feel like you don't have a handle on life, that there is kind of a light in all of us that can keep us going, keep us happy. Yeah.
Kimberly?
I would say playing the Ghost of Christmas Past has been a really fun challenge for me because she's otherworldly. She takes up a lot of space, which I don't always get to do. Like, I get to descend upon an old crotchety man from a swing and be like, hey, pay attention to me and fix yourself. And that's awesome. And so it's just like being able to lean into like a little bit of tough love, but also like leaning into like being like an impish fairy spirit who also like inspires. Like every time that I come out on the swing, all the little kids in the audience gasp. And it's because they're just like, they can't believe that a woman would appear out of the sky next to all of these glittering ribbons. And that's it's just like Christmas Past has really reminded me of like all of the different ways that we can bring kindness to people in our lives through so many different ways, through like, you know, showing up. Christmas Past also reminds me of like all the teachers that I've had and like helps me understand them. I feel like I'm talking in circles a little bit.
No, you're doing great.
But thank you, Jomar. Thank you, Jomar. But it's just like she's just really kind of helped me remember how to be kind and how to really take care of people, even in the ways that they don't want to be taken care of, you know?
So part of that is you're seeing that in the role, and part of that is the role being brought out in you?
Yeah. I like to take care of people, but I'm not always one for tough love. Like, I'm like, oh, no, I can't do this. I'm going to hurt them. And Christmas Past is like, no, you got to do this. You must. You must. It is what happened. So that's helpful for me.
What do you both think has kept this story alive for lo these many years?
Huh. Well, I think there are a couple of things. I'll start with saying, so a lot of people call Charles Dickens the father of Christmas.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah, because, and this is what we talked about in one of our dramaturgy meetings, is that like Christmas wasn't necessarily celebrated in the way that it was today, mm-hmm. Back in Dickens' time. And so Dickens like wrote this fantasy that he had for this holiday. Like he was like, what if we all got together and just tried to be happy and tried to give each other everything we could for just like this one day of the year? And then people read it and thought, wow, what would that be like? And then they started doing that, or at least, you know, a good number of people did. And so I think that this story just reminds everybody kind of like the heart of what it is to spend holidays with people that you love and how to like treat each other the way that you really feel like you should be treated.
Yeah.
Jomar?
Yeah, it definitely brings out the spirit of Christmas, you know, the spirit of giving, the spirit of being with family. And I mean, who doesn't like to see a good transformation? Seeing Scrooge.
I love it.
Yeah, seeing Scrooge be this like, whew, he's a lot to take in to, you know, at the end of like, oh, what a gentle, gentle man, you know?
Yeah.
Who doesn't love that kind of thing? And gosh, you know, I feel like I've been saying joy this whole interview, and that's the only way I can describe it in the most purest way. It just brings out the joy in people, mm-hmm. you know.
Do you have people come backstage afterwards or see you at the stage door and tell you how much they've enjoyed the production?
Yeah. Last night we had an elementary class come up on stage to take a picture with two of our ghosts, and I've never had so many little kids just like come up to me without saying anything and just hug me.
Yeah,
I was still in costume, but it was really awesome.
I walked past these kids during the student matinee, and I'm in my beanie and I'm in my backpack. They say, "Hey, good job, Mr. Cratchit." And I was like, oh, I'm not used to be called Mr. Cratchit, or even yeah. Mister for that case.
The curtain yeah. calls during the student matinees are crazy. Like all the kids are like, it's awesome.
It's yeah. wonderful to be inspiring. Thank you, Jomar Tagatak and Kimberly Holkamp Dinan. Am I pronouncing it correct?
It's Holkamp Dinan, but that's
Dinan.
All right.
No, it's not all right. Holkamp Dinan. Thank you. From ACT's annual holiday production of A Christmas Carol. Now in its 43rd year, Christmas Carol is a cornerstone of ACT's repertory. And you can find it running through December 24th at the Geary Theater, 415 Geary Street in San Francisco. And you can go online and find it as well. We thank you so very, very much for being with us this afternoon on KLW.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome back to KALW. This is pre-recorded. We'll be talking today about San Francisco Ballet's holiday production of The Nutcracker, which marks the 75th anniversary of the tradition of presenting Tchaikovsky's ballet in San Francisco. It was on Christmas Eve, 1944, that the company presented America's first full-length Nutcracker at the War Memorial Opera House before making stops in Oakland, Sacramento, and Stockton. The 75th anniversary production of The Nutcracker dates from 2004, and it is set in San Francisco and was created by San Francisco Ballet's artistic director and principal choreographer, Helgi Thomason. The production runs through December 29th at the War Memorial Opera House, and of course that's at 301 Venice Avenue in San Francisco.
Rufus, welcome to Open Air.
Thanks for having me.
I should actually say welcome back to Open Air because you have been a guest of my predecessor, Alan Farley.
Yes, Alan Farley. I think I was on the show two or three times, a long time ago.
What's your first memory of actually hearing this incredible Tchaikovsky score?
Nutcracker, I think every child has heard it sometime growing up, elementary school, high school. So there's no real memory. It's like having a sister born before you. You don't remember where you never meet them. They're just there. Nutcracker was just there. It's everywhere. It's on television. And now with the cell phones, it's ringtones. It's everywhere in the supermarket. Everywhere I go is a Nutcracker going on.
And so then as you were growing up playing bassoon, you have a strong memory of the first time you actually played the music as opposed to hearing it.
You know, the first time I played the Nutcracker was with the ballet. I don't remember playing it in youth orchestra or anything like that. It was San Francisco. It was my Nutcracker debut.
And you've been going strong at it since, 1980 or so, both in the ballet and the opera?
Both in the ballet and the opera. A little stint with the I was with the symphony before both of those. And so I think I have about 42 years total in the opera house with all three jobs. Wow. Never had to change my locker.
Well, I know from experience as a flutist that this score is very technically challenging and quite a workout. Is that true for the bassoonist as well?
When we put the Nutcracker on audition lists, and believe it or not, it's the Nutcracker that knocks out most of the bassoon players. The Nutcracker will kill you.
It's a Nutcracker.
There is some technical things in the Nutcracker that will just tie your fingers into knots, and it's usually in the first round we put the Nutcracker because it eliminates so many bassoon players.
Saves a lot of time.
It's horrible, but that's the business, you know, and you have to play it in order to play in the ballet.
What should the listener be listening for as they're listening to the ballet and focusing on the bassoon in those tough parts?
Oh, we're in the score. Oh, just watch the bassoon player and see if he's cursing or not. If he still has the horn in his mouth, he's doing pretty well.
So night after night, year after year, now is the primary motivation the paycheck?
For Nutcracker? Yeah, that's part of it. I mean, let's get real here. We live in San Francisco, you know? It is, but I also get to see my colleagues. You know, only part of the opera orchestra plays in the ballet orchestra, so I don't see part of my colleagues for half a year a lot of the time. So it's a lot of fun to get back with my colleagues when I'm so ready to do Nutcracker after the opera season. It's just perfect. You sort of get on that ship and sail with your colleagues. So I'm ready to do it. I actually enjoy being in town. I come in a little later, you know. I don't have to be in till 2 o'clock, and we get home earlier than the opera. So I get out at 9 rather than midnight. So for me, it's perfect. I love it. And 3 hours in between to mess around in the city, and so it's fun. Okay. And then I go home.
And at this point, a lot of it is muscle memory, right? You just got to make sure your chops are ready, but you must be able to almost do this on autopilot.
You would think that. You would think that, but I still have to work on that darn Nutcracker music because it just doesn't stick. You know, it's not like eggs and bacon in the morning. It doesn't stick to your ribs. This stuff. You have to keep it going. People always ask me, "How about you could play this in your sleep?" I wish I could. I really wish I could. But the best part about it is it's hard. That's really good because we do so many. So you're always challenged. Every day you're thinking, you know, I'm trying to set a record of playing this passage. You know, can I do it 30 times perfectly? That kind of thing. Yeah. So you still have to keep your chops going, absolutely, because it's not an easy score, so you never get bored, ever.
Yeah. And, of course, as a bassoonist, you've also got the added challenge of making sure you have the right reed.
Oh, I don't like to say the R word, but yeah. But, yeah, those darn reeds. There's that, and... hopefully I have some left over from opera season that I could finagle through the Nutcracker, you know. But, yeah, you have the reed problem, that issue.
Some 31 performances per season or thereabouts. That must make for some interesting and probably maddening earworms for you.
Earworms. Well, I don't know. It's, I'm not sure what an earworm is.
A melody that just won't get out of your head, that you something that just is stuck there over and over again, whether it's the ballet, the waltz, or the waltz of the flowers.
The waltz of the flowers can stick in your head a little bit. And when you walk into a CVS and hear it on a speaker, you pretty much want to strangle everybody. But it's good. It's all good.
Is there a memorable, after all these years, is there a memorable performance that you can recall, maybe a missed entrance by yourself or something, some sort of a mishap either in the pit or on the stage?
Oh, the best one of all. We were out of the house. We were in Los Angeles. And we're playing in Pasadena. And the stage is almost at shoulder level. Our heads are right next to the stage. Well, they use this huge mechanical rat. I think he's built on a car chassis. And it's remote control. One day, the rat just flew off the stage right between me and the clarinet and hit the music stands and hit the floor. And then you could see whoever was in control couldn't find it anymore. So the thing kept going, and we couldn't play. We were laughing so hard at this huge rat.
The performance.
And I had some family in the audience watching in binoculars, and we were at dinner, and I didn't want to bring this up. I didn't say, I'm not going to bring this up. I won't say anything. Finally, at the end of the table, my cousin, "Hey, Roof, what's with the big rat?" And he said, "Well, did you think it was part of the show?" He said, "No." He said, "Because we were watching your face." It couldn't have been part of the show. We were watching your face. And well, that I remember that really well. Well, think that Thor was still with us, you know.
Hopefully the rat is a little bit more secured in this performance.
Oh, I hope so. Put a string on him. Do something. But yeah. But the big rat incident was a funny moment.
Now, most of these performances will be conducted by Martin West, a steady hand on the podium over many years.
I love working with Martin. Martin is a real advocate for the orchestra. He's one of the best music directors I've ever had. And you feel like he's one of us. Well, he's not just your conductor, but he's part of the orchestra. So it's always good to have some. And, you know, we rehearsed, believe it or not, we rehearsed the Nutcracker the day before. And every year he might have some new insights into the music. So you're always getting something. So it's always fun.
Nice. I've talked with Martin on a number of occasions, and his enthusiasm knows no bounds. And speaking of conductors, congratulations on the new appointment of the conductor of the opera.
Eunsun Kim. Oh, she's fabulous. We're having a real love fest right now with her, and it's a lot of fun. We really enjoy working with her. I do. I can speak for myself, at least, that I love I'm very happy about this. Mm-hmm. Very happy. And it's historical also. I think it's a fabulous thing that it says to the world that we're all the same, basically. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful.
Nice. And, you know, speaking of now talking with Rufus Olivier II, I have the pleasure of calling Rufus Olivier III a friend, and I've played with him on a number of occasions. A classic example of like father, like son. Was it always in Rufus III's stars to play bassoon?
I didn't encourage it. I wanted a doctor or a lawyer, but but you know, when he was about 8 or 9, I had a lovely student by the name of John Hoover, and unfortunately, he was an older student at San Francisco State, and he passed away, and John left his bassoon to my son, and that's when my son started playing bassoon at about 8 or 9 years old. Wow. And you know, I didn't say a word. I didn't, you know, and he just took to it. So he played with me. We've played Ring Cycles in the opera. We've played Nutcracker. We've played everything in the opera. He played next to me for at least 4 years, solid.
So the boy has some chops.
He's got a lot of chops. He's got more chops than I got. I got pork chops. He's got chop chops.
Rufus Olivier II, one of the featured players in the opera orchestra, or the ballet orchestra, along with some 60 others. Let's see, as of this broadcast, there are some 29 more opportunities between tonight and the 29th of December to catch the splendor of Helgi Thomasson's interpretation of the Tchaikovsky ballet. Featuring Rufus and some others, will you be there for all 29 of the remaining ones?
Yes, that is my goal. My goal is to play every single one, and I've done it. I've done it pretty good in the last number of years. Only once did I crack. But, yeah.
How many reads do you go through?
Oh, my goodness. Nutcracker takes about 3 or 4 reads, I think. Oh. Yeah. Just rotate.
Yeah. Well, we'll look forward to hearing you. And next time you're catching the ballet, dear listener, take a lean over to the pit and wave to Rufus Olivier II. Thanks for talking with us, Rufus.
It's a real pleasure. And I'll see you all out there, and bring your kids. I love hearing the children in the audience. That's always fun to hear a yelp or two from the little ones.
And some fun facts: with some 600 pounds of artificial snow being dropped by 4 stagehands at each performance, that makes for, let's see, 29 times 6 distributed by 4. Carry them. Oh, well, you do the math. And let's not forget the stagecraft involved to make the Christmas tree grow to over 30 feet tall each evening as well. Thrill to the Christmas tree. Be dazzled by the 300 to 500 Swarovski crystals on the Snow Queen's tutu. Be astounded that the ballerina doll in Act 1 sports an 18-pound tutu. And be ever so slightly envious of the $11,000 costume of Clara's godfather, the magician and toy maker Herr Drosselmeyer, who brings that doll to life. San Francisco Ballet's Nutcracker runs through the 29th. Tickets and much more information at sfballet.org.
David LaTulip getting into the reeds with our guest. Rufus, Rufus was one of the awardees when I was press secretary to Mayor Frank Jordan for Black History Month in 1992. And to follow his career over the years is quite a treat. A lot of things have happened this day, December 12th, and let's go through some of them. Some of them are very coincidental. Sammy Davis was born this day in Wilmington, North Carolina. Not the Sammy Davis, Sammy Davis Sr., oddly enough. I met Sammy Davis at one point. I was doing a benefit for Vince Hallen, and he was running against Carl Allen for judge. And I was thinking, what would be a good song for Vince Hallen? He's such an unusual person. I Gotta Be Me. No sooner than I stopped singing I Gotta Be Me in the Grand Ballroom of the Hilton Hotel, this little 6.5 inch black guy walks from the back of the room. It's Sammy Davis. I wanted to dig a hole. I'm singing this guy's signature song, and he walks in. Fortunately, he was very gracious to me. Frank Sinatra was born this day in 1915. Big songs they have for him are Stranger Than Night, My Way, Actor From Here to Eternity. Old Blue Eyes, met him one time, which was great. I was filling in for Ron Owens when I was at KGO Radio, and he didn't want to go to a show that was up in Lake Tahoe, and I thought, I'll go. Got off the air at 5 o'clock, met my wife at 6. We took the bus up there, and it was for high rollers and media types. And I was at the dessert table, and all of a sudden I looked down the hallway, and these big burly bodyguards are moving this guy very quickly down the hall along with his beautiful wife. And they stopped about 10 feet in front of me. And my wife says to me, you know you're never going to get another chance. So very slowly, with both hands showing, I walked up and I said, I'd always wanted to meet you because I admire your work. He looked me over, and with one nod, he said to everybody else in that room, this guy approached me. Don't anybody else do the same. And his bodyguard said, had I not approached him in the right way, I would have been on the floor. So I've appreciated Frank Sinatra. I was, I think it was 4 years ago, 3 years ago, we did a tribute to him at the Herbst Theater here in San Francisco. We sold it out, which is great. 1933, Manu Dibango, Cameroonian musician, was born in Douala, French Cameroon. I love this one. Connie Francis, American singer and actress. Where the Boys Are. That was neat. They had a book when I was in college, law school actually, said where the Girls Are. And we would look it up and see if we could find places to go find potential mates. Born in Newark, New Jersey. Her real name was Concetta Franconera. Franconera. Now, a little closer to home, Dionne Warwick, American singer, solid gold. Do You Know the Way to San Jose? If you can believe this, she was born in East Orange, New Jersey. She's Whitney Houston's aunt. And also, when she recorded that song, she was given a key to the city because nobody else knew where San Jose was, what it was. So that's a long time ago because everybody knows San Jose these days. 1943, Grover Washington Jr., American jazz saxophonist, Mr. Magic, born in Buffalo, New York, died in 1999. Sheila E., American singer, drummer, percussionist, born in Oakland, California, homegirl. Okay, next week for Open Air, between December 9th, 12th and 19th. Next week's Open Air, KLW's radio magazine for performing arts guests host Leah Garchik will be talking about the African-American Shakespeare Company's unique annual holiday offering of Cinderella, the oft-told tale of a scullery maid determined to take her life into her own hands and make it better. Very few people know this, but there was a whole Shakespearean company in the village in the 1820s, and out of that came an actor by the name of Ira Aldridge. He became the toast of Europe, and in Stratford-on-Avon, there's only one seat named for an American actor, and that is Ira Aldridge, the finest American Shakespearean actor of the 19th century, and hardly anyone knows his name. Cinderella runs for four performances, December 20th through the 22nd at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco. And we talk with British award-winning writer and stand-up comedian Mark Mayer and local comedian and organizer Lisa Goldig about the 27th annual Kung Pao Kosher Comedy, Jewish comedy on Christmas in a Chinese restaurant. Shows are at the New Asia Restaurant in San Francisco's Chinatown on December 24th and 26th with two performances a day. Kung Pao answers the age-old question, what are Jews supposed to do on Christmas? Their humor, not mine. British violinist Daniel Hope is stopping by in his capacity as artistic partner of the New Century Chamber Orchestra to share details about the ensemble's Christmas concert series, together with internationally acclaimed Swedish mezzo-soprano Anne-Sophie von Otter. Performances are on December 18th, 7:30 p.m. at First United Methodist Church in Palo Alto, and on December 19th, 7:30 p.m. at St. Mark's Lutheran Church in San Francisco, and on December 20th, 7:30 p.m. at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley, a program by Bach, Vivaldi, Thad Jones, Irving Berlin, and others. Plus, Open Air's regular contributor and critics at large, Peter Robinson, shines his unique light on cultural events around the San Francisco Bay Area and offers some thoughts. I want to thank David Latulipe for allowing me to sit in, and a reminder of all our shows are archived. Just search on the air for KLW and the guest name. If you have any suggestions, send emails to david@klw.org. Many thanks to producer Neil Swinkels and also board engineer Jean Marie. Thank you for listening.